linguistic art chicks.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. And it sure is good to be back with you again. Seems like it's been too long since my last podcast. But we've got an interesting program today, one I think you'll get a lot out of. It's another recording from the Timothy Leary Archive, for which I want to thank Dennis Berry and Bruce Damer for sending it to me to podcast today. And I also want to thank two fellow Saloners who have donated some of their hard-earned cash to help offset the expenses associated with producing these podcasts. And these two friends of the Salon are Guy D. and Andy W. I know it takes an extra effort to remember to go to the psychedelicsalon.org webpage and make a donation. And so, Guy and Andy, I really appreciate your efforts and your support. And there's one more gigantic thank you that I want to pass along, and that is to the Magic Mutt Foundation, who sent me what can only be described as a grant. This is the second grant we've received in the 3.5 years of these podcasts, and I have to say that once again I'm blown away by people's generosity and by their dedication to helping us get the true information out about our sacred medicines and getting it out to as many people as we can reach. So how do we find the others, you ask? Well, I'll talk about that a little bit more at the end of today's program, but I'll tell you how I found the Magic Mutt Foundation. I went to a conference in Palenque, and on my second or third day there, I sat down by the pool and started talking with a man who we affectionately call Wild Bill. And now, almost 10 years later, with Wild Bill on one side of this continent and me on the other, we're still in touch. And in fact, we've had several grand adventures together in the interim. And then, just out of the blue, I get this grant from the Magic Mutt Foundation, which happens to be Wild Bill's new cover, I might add. And that is how the psychedelic community takes care of its own. So thanks again, Wild Bill. And as you told me, the way to thank you is to keep these podcasts coming your way as often as I can. And now you have a connection with Wild Bill as well. And there's always a chance you'll bump into him at Burning Man or COSM or at the conference somewhere. And when you do, you can also give him your thanks for keeping the psychedelic spirit alive. And talk about keeping the spirit alive, I've noticed that several of our fellow Saloners are now linking to our site, and I also appreciate your help. Each of us, in our own ways, are doing what we can to help spread the word about our worldwide community of psychedelic thinkers, us average people who are just trying to figure out a few better ways to live our short lives on this beautiful little planet. We're all in this together, you know, and I can't think of another group I'd rather make my stand with. But since life is so short, I'd better get on with today's program, which is an interview with Dr. Timothy Leary. This tape is from the Leary Archive, as I said, and it was noted that the person asking the questions was Elsonite Thompson, and that the interview took place in the San Francisco Bay Area sometime in January of 1966. Now, in this interview, Tim doesn't mention the fact that on January 3rd, which must have only been a week or so earlier, Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters, along with their house band, The Grateful Dead, conducted the first of their famous acid tests at the Fillmore. So the LSD vibe was already in the Bay Area air on the day of this interview. And now I think that as we listen to this, it's also important to keep in mind when you hear him describe things like the light show they're about to put on, that this is 1966 technology. There were no personal computers or lasers back then, but what he is describing was actually a state-of-the-art multimedia experience for the time. So now let's pretend that we are back in the first month of 1966. And I know that'll be difficult for some of you because you weren't here then. But back then, the war in Vietnam is just now heating up. Segregation is still the law in much of the land. The threat of a sudden nuclear war is constantly being talked about, and the baby boomers are just entering college. Now, let's pretend that you and I are sitting at home in the Bay Area, where We're either in high school or college, and we turn on our radios and hear this Harvard professor talking about a new religion whose initials are LSD. I wonder what we would have made of this back then. My guess is that for at least some of the people who heard Dr. Leary that night, well, for them, it was probably the beginning of what we now call the 60s. One of the predictions you'll hear Dr. Leary make in a few minutes was that within a year or so, anywhere from one-third to two-thirds of all the kids in school, that's high school and college, would be presented with an opportunity to try LSD and or cannabis. Now, I don't know if that happened or not, but I do know that many historians say that what they mean by the 60s was a period that actually began around 1967. Now, one thing I do know about that part of the country around that time is that there was a lot of really good acid going around back then. So now try to clear your mind of everything that you know about the 60s and about psychedelics and pretend that you're a novice about all this stuff. And now let's turn on our January 1966 radios and join Dr. Timothy Leary.
Well, what brings you to the Bay Area at this particular time, Dr. Leary?
Of course, I'm an old Bay Area resident. I still own a home, as a matter of fact, in Berkeley, so I consider that when I come back here, I'm not completely a visitor. The reason I'm coming right now is that January 27th and 28th, we are going to bring our psychedelic religious celebration to Berkeley and San Francisco.
Well, now, what would that mean?
Well,
it's referred to, I believe, as a concert.
Oh, no.
Isn't it?
No.
Well, somebody used that phrase in describing it, and I wonder what that could mean.
Well, let me backtrack a bit to put this in context. As you probably know, 3 months ago, we formed a new religion called League for Spiritual Discovery. Like every other religion, we have our own sacramental methods and our own goals. And we practice the religion in small groups privately. But like other religious groups, we have our public educational and demonstration ceremonies, which we call celebrations.
And the private ones are the esoteric side of the situation,
yes.
I gather. And the public ones are, as all religions have been, translated for the masses.
Or not so much the masses as the non-initiated or the non-communicants. This, of course, is the... This may sound strange to Americans, but actually it's the most orthodox form of religion. And indeed, it's not that much different from the way that, for example, the Catholic Church or the Jewish religion operates. You have your sacramental services, which are reserved to the communicants, and then you present to the public what your aspirations are, and you try to show people what you're discovering. So for the last 3 months in New York City, every Tuesday night we've been running what we call psychedelic religious celebrations.
Could you tell me something about them in more detail? I think there are a number of people in our audience who have some concept of what the psychedelic experience is, and I'd like you to speak fairly directly to what you do.
Yes, well, thousands of years men have been having what we now call psychedelic experiences, mystics, visionaries, far-out artists and poets. And after you have this experience, you struggle, you hunger to communicate it, mainly, of course, for yourself. It's a way of reminding yourself what it was, but also to communicate to your fellow men. We think that every religious group in its origin struggled to start a new art. And indeed, you can test the validity of any new religion by the art that it creates, because words, after all, are a fragile freight for carrying the deepest impulses of man. So like other religions in the past, we have developed our own art form. Rather, it is automatically developed. Psychedelic art is the public face or the communication device of our new religion. Now, what is psychedelic art? Psychedelic art is multi-energy. Instead of using one form of light or of movie or of slides, we will have up to 26 slide projectors and motion picture cameras or projectors going on one huge CinemaScope screen. The screen is undulating with cellular forms and changing patterns, stroboscopic flashes, and swimming in and out of this Niagara of visual material are what we call mythic forms. It's as though your own protein memory banks, your genetic code, is being decoded, and these millions of file cards that have been stored for thousands of years begin to flash. Each week in our celebration, we reenact or we renew one of the great ancient religious stories. We've just finished doing the reincarnation of Jesus Christ. In the present time, we're doing the illumination of the Buddha. These great religious figures of the past are men who have been turned on and who have worked out a new metaphor for stating the divine plan or the way things are. And we seek to use modern methods, electronic and multimedia, to turn on the audience, literally.
Do you use sound?
Oh, yes. We use up to six or eight sources of sound, some live and some tapes. We'll have four and five tapes going at one time, for example.
Well, now, what is the net result of this in terms of what you expect the members of your audience to do? Is this to encourage them to use LSD, or is it to encourage them to reach some kind of expanded level of awareness without such use? Because whether or not psychedelic aids were invoked, it is obviously true that all the great religious teachers were aware in a quite different way of the reality around them than the average human being.
They had altered perception.
Is this something you simply want people to accept as being a fact? Is it something you feel all people should experience? What's the implementation here?
Well, as I said before, the aims and goals of our religion are highly orthodox. We seek to find the divinity within, call that what you will. But it's been well known for thousands of years that man can focus his microscope inside and turn on to energies and revelations which are built into your nervous system and your cells. Your body is an instrument of communication which has been around for 2 billion years, and there's a lot to learn from it. Now, we don't want other people necessarily to use our sacraments, LSD and marijuana. We're not advocating the use of these. And in our celebrations, which we'll be putting on January 27th and 28th here in the Bay Area, there'll be no attempt to urge people to use drugs. We are attempting to get people to turn inside, to look within, and to turn on. And we don't care what sacrament people use. Throughout human history, the human race has used the most incredible variety of techniques for turning on. They've used flagellation and dance. They've used immobility, solitude, noise,
meditation.
Exactly, meditation, fasting, sacramental foods. The interesting thing is that man's attempt to turn on just staggers the imagination. It's hardly anything that hasn't been used one time or another in one culture or another to get this experience. And often the most opposite things have been used. It's well known that overstimulation and noise and crowds is one way of flipping you out of your external mind within. On the other hand, silence and silence.
Mobs, in other
Mobs,
words.
Mobs, yes, or chanting, or you get a large group together and you get a kind of a hypnotic effect. Sexual renunciation is one method. On the other hand, ritual use of sex, where the mates become gods and goddesses for each other, is another. Of course, throughout human history, men have used chemicals, plants, vines, roots. Wine itself was originally a sacramental method of turning people on. So we don't care what method people use. We treasure and glorify any method that can get you high, that is, can turn you on. But we also insist that no one tell us we can't use our sacrament if it seems to work for us.
Well, now, there are a number of aspects of this that I would like to ask some fairly frank questions about. I have heard it stated, and with some understanding, that some of the people who become involved with the use of LSD, that it becomes a sort of dead end. In other words, here is an experience which is highly stimulating and extremely exciting in the deepest sense of the word. And the repetition of that experience, the sort of going off in a corner, as it were, mentally and spiritually, becomes some kind of an end in itself. I've heard it stated that quite a number of creative people, for example, who have gotten into this, no longer produce. Now, I'm going to pose a theory, namely that the proper use of such awareness is bound up with what you bring back and implement in the society around you, and that it, as everything can be abused, so could these methods of hyper-awareness be abused, and in fact have been abused, because I presume that black magic is exactly using the same powers. And I have the idea that no one creates, either in their life or in any visual outward sense, without submitting themselves to some kind of discipline, either their own or some higher discipline to which they are prepared to submit. Now, where along this line does the creative, in sense of our society, in sense of the world that we live in, how do you tie this all in?
Well, you've raised several points, and I find myself in complete agreement with each point as I followed what you just said. Number one, the internal experience cannot be the final goal. Of course, monastics and people in my profession, shamans and alchemists and people who have attempted to change consciousness for thousands of years have debated this point. As a matter of fact, in Southeast Asia, there are two schools of Buddhism. Northern Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, says exactly what you've just said. It's one thing to turn on, but then you've got to come back to society and make it show in your behavior. There's another school of Buddhism, as most of your listeners probably know, Southern Buddhism, which says, no, just stay high all the time. Anything is a trap in the way of going back to society. Well, we belong to the school which believes that by your fruits you shall be known. It's inconceivable to us that people could take LSD regularly and not be driven to come back to society and to try to glorify or to express what they have learned.
And what is it that you think they have learned?
Well, it's highly individual, obviously. And of course, you mentioned the misuse of LSD. It's obvious. Every form of energy that man has invented has been misused. I think the auto engine is misused. I think even radio and television is misused by most other stations. It's too much to ask that our new form of energy, which is released by LSD, is going to immediately cause everyone to become an ecstatic and productive saint. On the other hand, all we can do is say over and over again, every lecture and every performance that we give to the public, that discipline and training and a conscientious attempt to express productively is the inevitable result of your LSD experience. And I think that's one of the tragedies, that many people take LSD and are so entranced and delighted by this internal world that they just turn off the external world. And this inevitably leads to tragedy, because you just can't stir up all this energy and get so many ideas flashing without harnessing it up. And if you don't do that, then you get this endless rumination and you get the so-called LSD freakout, where the person is just spinning around in his own mind. The motto of our religion is turn on, tune in, and drop out. Turn on, of course, means contact these internal possibilities. Tune in means harness it back in works of art, in works of beauty, in works of harmony. So I couldn't agree with you more when you make these comments about...
And what's the dropout?
Well, this is an easily misinterpreted phrase. By dropout, we mean drop out of meaningless activities. We don't mean drop out of life. We don't mean drop out of the really meaningful behaviors. We're convinced, and I think it wouldn't be hard to prove my point, that most Americans are involved in a meaningless robot assembly line, a series of activities. They don't really know what they're doing or why they're doing it, but they just push down to this assembly line and off they go. We tell people to drop out. This is the oldest message of visionary prophets, which happens to be my profession. My trade union has always come back to society and said, look, detach yourself from the immediate tribal and be very careful how you spend your time and in what sort of activity you dedicate your energies. So by drop out, we don't mean just to sit around and grow a beard and discuss the ultimates in philosophy. We mean drop out of the meaningless and tune in to the productive. We live, for example, in a large estate in upper New York. There are 60 of us who have dropped out of American society. We think we have our own country there. In addition to starting our own religion, we start our own country, and we leave our little plot of land. I consider I'm going back to the planet Earth and to the United States in a friendly message of communication. And we are trying to develop their pilot study of how man can drop out, how Americans can drop out of the robot aspects of our society and tune back into the more basic human activities, which are familial, which are tribal, and which are involved in individual acts of beauty rather than huge mass movements of power and efficiency.
Well, how do you solve the practical side of life? Because one of the things which has always struck me about Western society is that unless you're, well, practically, I guess, unless you're involved with the Catholic Church, no matter how much a human being might wish to devote themselves to the good of the world, there are not very many channels for this, you see. Now, in India, for example, it's quite customary that a person works productively for a certain number of years, and then they simply pack up and disappear into the great sea of life. And somehow or another, their society, however meagerly, is geared to accept this, and to do something about the survival of these people, because society feels that these people, in their own odd way, have great value. What do you, supposing anyone were involved in the process of dropping out, what do they do to survive?
Well, there are two ways this has been done throughout human history. One is the way you suggest, and that's not just Indian. See, the Catholic Church, as you point out today,
quite.
Supports thousands and thousands of monastics.
And did all during the medieval and the Dark Age period and so on, and acted without any question as the carrier of the culture.
Yeah.
A culture that practically inevitably would have died without that concentration of power at the given point.
I think you're going to see a return to this tradition in the United States today. Our country is now so affluent, and we have the problem of leisure, that I think that we're going to be able to tolerate in the future more and more Americans dropping out for a limited space of time, perhaps for a longer space of time. It's no longer an economic problem if several million Americans just retire to a life of meditation and contemplation. But that's not...
It wouldn't be if they were accepted by the society.
Yeah.
It would be for the millions of Americans who did it, if they did
well,
it tomorrow,
the Protestant,
for example.
Puritan ethic... You see, it was the Protestant Church which knocked out the monistic tradition. The Protestant Church glorifies work, virtue, and money in the bank. And we're licking that, and that's one of the campaigns we have going to teach Americans that the Protestant ethic just doesn't work anymore, and we're going to have to tolerate more people dropping out and following the spiritual life. But that's not the real central solution that we see. There's a second way in which people have dropped out in the past, and I would cite the men who founded this country, the Pilgrims and the different groups who dropped out of England. They said to the fellows over there, we don't like your establishment, and we're going to drop out of it, and they climbed in leaky boats and came over here, and they started their own tribal culture, which is essentially what it was, and they worked hard, and they built up their own economic system, and that's how America was founded. We're returning in our little colony in Millbrook to the original American formula. Now, we can't climb in leaky boats and find an island someplace because our globe is no longer open. So we have gone up to upper New York State, and we've done as the Pilgrims have done. We set up our own economic community. We can support ourselves. And surprisingly enough, when you think about it, there are many ways in which small groups who want it, who just can't take this society in its industrial computer sense, can support themselves. Because as our society in its lemming-like rush to the cities gets into this mass, urban insanity, there are enormous vacuums and gaps that are left where thoughtful people can move back into the country and make a way of life. There's one thing that a machine culture can't do, and they can't really please the senses. It's very hard for a machine-made object to do what works of art are supposed to do, really delight the hands and delight the eye and delight the body. So that in many, each of these groups that drops out of society in the next 5 or 6 years, 10 years, is going to have to work out its own economic method. They're going to have establish a favorable balance of exchange with a larger society. And if you're not competent enough and creative enough to do that, you're not ready to drop out. See, our motto is turn on. You have to get the revelation first. After you've turned on, tune it back in acts of production and beauty, then you're ready to drop out. And if you're not creative enough and free enough, and if your LSD sessions haven't given you enough real meaning that you can do this, then you obviously haven't learned your LSD lesson, and you're not ready to drop out.
Well, it still seems to me, observing the scene around me, that there is some danger here, and you have talked about this earlier in this conversation, of people, particularly very young people, who do not perhaps bring enough experience, enough suffering, enough knowledge to this process, where the simple use of LSD could be highly fraught with danger.
Yes, I deplore the social reality of hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of high school and college students taking LSD and not knowing what they're opening up. On the other hand, it's also a social reality that they're going to do it. Just like the automobile is here and it can be misused, the kids are going to use alcohol, they're going to use any form of energy around, they are going to use LSD. I see the current younger generation as a transition generation. We gave them a world which was meaningless. They're trying to salvage the best that they can from it. I think we should be very patient with this younger generation. And the only solution, of course, is training and education and preparation. And that's why we're bringing our celebrations to the West Coast. Our celebrations are not entertainments, although we hope they're entertaining. They're mainly didactic. We're trying to show people what the LSD experience is. We're trying to show people how to use it. It's quite didactic in the sense that each celebration takes up different sense organs and different levels of consciousness. At times I get very dry in my sermon explaining to people what they're seeing on the screen. Training and discipline and of course suffering is part of any yoga. And I want to say this about LSD. Sometimes people think that LSD is just pure ecstasy. It's not. There's nothing in life that doesn't have the other side to the coin. And as you leave your tribal mind with its narrow limits and open up these other possibilities, there's just as much potentiality for fear as there is for delight. And that's where the training comes in, how to handle the fear and how to not let it bowl you over and how to harness these energies.
You speak repeatedly of the internal experience of LSD, meaning, I presume, the working out within the human being of whatever expansion of consciousness is achieved. But it is also true that this has a very incredible effect on the physical plane and on all of the sensory processes.
That's what I mean by internal. See,
that's why I wanted you to clarify the...
Western man has been so deceived by his priests and by his bureaucratic institutional religions. Most of the great gospels and teachings of the past are absolutely correct, except that our priests have externalized them. When Christ said, seek ye the kingdom of heaven, it is within, he meant that literally. It's within your body. The aim of our religion is to ask man to come to his senses. You have to learn how to use your sense organs and how to deal with the energies which inundate the retina of your eye and the delicate membrane of your ear. You have to go out of your mind to come to your senses. You have to learn how to resurrect your body. Christ meant that literally, that the revelation is in tissue. The revelation is in cell. And this is what we learned from LSD, and we're not inventing an imaginary soul inside. To me, the soul, one aspect of the soul is a genetic code, which is a tiny little strand of protein which has the entire blueprint and memory of 2 billion years of life on this planet. These are the exciting territories that you can get into if you know what you're doing with LSD.
I have always suspected that either the great religious teachers were completely irrelevant, or else what they said was not some kind of pious hope, but in fact an observation of fact.
Exactly. That's something else that most Americans and Westerners don't realize, that the science of consciousness is just as regular, just as lawful, and just as complicated as the science of energies outside. One of the early mottos of my profession was her hermetic code. It was on the Emerald Tablet of Hermes back in Alexandria. It says, what is without is within. That's simply reminding us that there's no energy transformation that you find outside around you that isn't recorded in protein historical records inside your body. Even now, when it comes to space exploration, as I have taken LSD and hurtled around inside inner space, there are all sorts of unidentified flying objects in the metaphorical sense that whiz by your projectors. All of the political and all of the scientific problems of the external world have been worked out over and over again by your cells and your tissues. And unless you get into some contact with this, we think that you're really kind of a robot just being pushed around and reacting to external forces.
In what role, and at what level of that role, do you visualize yourself, Dr. Larry?
Well, I've given a great deal of thought to that. I think, as I read history, and of course in my profession, which is religious teacher or shaman, you have to look back. We have our tradition, just like the physicist knows about Einstein and Bohr and Newton. I have studied the earlier adepts in my profession, which is the changing of consciousness. I don't think we're ever going to have any more holy men or any more messiahs, and I hope we're not going to have any more martyrs. You see, 1,000 years ago, if someone stumbled on a new method of turning on, maybe it was the Buddha over in India, his original method was the sit-down. He sat under that tree and stayed there till the sit-in. He found a method, and he came back and he taught it. Well, by the time that method and that the name of the Buddha reached the Mediterranean, it was maybe 100 years. Slave galleys and folk singers, and it's always the young and the lower class and the alienated that carry the message. By the time it got over the Mediterranean, the Buddha was perhaps two or three generations dead. So then you set him up as a special person who had a virgin birth or miraculous death and so forth. That's not true. He was just a human being struggling to find meaning the way the rest of us are. Now, in the present technological age, you see, that's never going to happen. When we announced the formation of our religion in New York 3 months ago at 10 o'clock in the morning, by 10:10 it was on the news ticker in London, and 10:15 it was on the news ticker in Tokyo, and probably 10:17 it was on the news ticker in Peking, and they were wondering, Mike, what are they doing over there now? There's no more room for mythological, supernatural religious teachers. I'm simply an American of Irish descent with all of the faults and virtues of my time and culture, struggling for meaning, and we have got a method which works for those people who know how to use it, so that I don't see myself as a historical figure in this old sense. We're not going to have any of these legendary...
Messiahs.
Yeah, that's right. I think that religion in the future is going to be much more personal. Every man should start his own religion. That's my advice to young people today. Don't think it was all done 2,000 years ago or 500 years ago. The great challenge of human life is really to found your own religion. That means you personally cast off your tribal mind and come to real tissue and fleshly grip with these ancient problems, and you hammer out your own ethical code on your tablets of whatever they are. You become your own Copernicus. You probe these mysteries yourself and come out with your own answers. Now, you're going to come out with pretty much the same answers that Christ and the Buddha came up with, because that's the science of it. There are certain basic truths, but you can't take them in cliche, static form. Nobody can pass on these truths to anyone else, or they're just meaningless formula. You have to have your dark night of the soul. You have to have your LSD flip out. You have to wonder what's real, who am I, and then slowly you're going to have to recapitulate the evolution history of the human race yourself. And that's what the challenge of LSD is. And come out with your own prayers, your own rituals, which work for you and your family and perhaps a few friends. That's the excitement of it. And we deplore the mass conformity of most religions today, which become just like General Motors and NBC television.
You mention repeatedly the universe as being contained within each body. Has your group any attitude about the universe when not contained within a body?
You're asking about immortality. Whenever that question comes up, I know the conversation is getting to a higher and higher level. We're no longer talking about danger and the social problem of one generation of Americans struggling for a new social order.
Well, it can't have failed to occur to you.
Right, hilarious. Yeah. That's a good sign that the interview is progressing nicely. You know, we have no answers to the question of immortality, it seems, and of course each person has to work this out himself. I don't think that my body, with my appendectomy and my gold tooth and my graying hair, is going to reappear in a new afterlife. The words of another great member of my profession, St. Thomas, come to mind. He said, why do ye ask about the end when you have not found the beginning? If you find the beginning, then you realize that questions about immortality are game questions. They're chessboard questions. Does a tree ask about immortality? Does the honeybee ask those questions? No, because they're tuned in. They know exactly where they came from. They know where they are in the entire process, and they realize that the process goes on, and that immortality is really turning on and locating yourself in this timeless process. Once you've really had this experience, this classic visionary mystic experience, when you're really tuned into the entire picture, you don't worry about immortality anymore. You've had it. You know you're immortal right this second, even though...
If you are ever going to be.
Right. Even though your body is wearing out and you have to face the fact that the whole universe is going to end. That's the beauty of some of these ancient Indian myths, which make perfect LSD sense. They talk about cycles of history and cycles of evolution. Vishnu goes through all the reincarnations, and then he goes to sleep for several billion years, and then he wakes up again. These are the cycles of nature, of growing and dying of light and darkness. And there is an immortal sense or a cyclical sense to this, which really satisfies me much more than the notion that my body, with its particular scars and stigmata, will be around again in another circle.
Well, of course, there have been religions which believed that the physical resurrection of the body was not an essential part of this process of immortality. So the gold tooth wouldn't necessarily have to come along with it.
But we certainly believe in the soul, and the closest definition we give to the soul is a genetic code. That's an invisible, ancient, incredibly intelligent blueprinting apparatus with enormous power to spin off bodies the way Detroit assembly lines spin out new models of cars, and which is almost a timeless process. And we literally think that man's nervous system can decode the genetic code. After all, the genetic code produced our nervous system and is in touch with it that way. Why can't we contact it the other way?
Well, in the some of the Eastern religions, at least, one of the things, if I have understood it, which arises is whether or not the sense of personal identity is maintained throughout this process. And that, I think, is something which causes considerable concern
right.
to many people. And if I have understood it properly, there is a very widespread school of mystic thought which believes that simply all is one all
yep.
the time.
Right.
It is just
yep.
a question of recognizing the interrelatedness of all life, and that this totality
yeah.
is what is the reality, rather than the narrowing down
to
of,
one
of the, this particular
century.
Focus
yeah.
point,
yeah.
focal point, which yeah. is what you conceive to be you.
Yeah. Well, of course, that's where the science of internal exploration is very convincing once you study the ancient texts. All of the great visionary mystic philosophers, East and West, come up with the same data, that it's all one process, and if you can just throw off your tribal mind and participate in this greater flow, you'll see that. Now, the embarrassing thing about the human mind is that 99.99% of your nervous system, which is your seat of consciousness, doesn't know that you exist, or doesn't know, in my case, that Timothy Leary exists. Now this
and
is,
couldn't care less.
And couldn't care less with our little problems of ambition and status and so forth. All that they're concerned with is that we keep the universe alive and going. And, of course, we're basically seed carriers. From the standpoint of genetic code, we're here to carry on the flame of life. Now, here's where we get into the LSD psychosis, or the LSD freakout. For several years now, we have defined... Of course, we think that psychiatry is our modern devil inquisition. Psychiatrists don't know what psychosis is and have no cure for it. Sure, they can load you up with tranquilizers and make you neat and tidy in the back ward, but psychiatry has not come up with the answer to psychosis. But we use this word psychosis the way we use the word devil or devil possession or witchcraft 200, 300, 400, or 500 years ago. Now, the LSD psychosis, or the LSD panic, we think is a religious crisis. And it comes exactly and routinely this way, that the person takes LSD and suddenly discovers that 99% of his nervous system doesn't know or care about him. Then he begins to scream, "Where's Shattuck Avenue? Where's the University of California? Where's Timothy Leary?" And your nervous system is inundating your consciousness with these enigmatic, smiling cellular transformations. Never heard of Timothy Leary. Nope, never heard of Berkeley. What's all that about? It's the language of tissue in this relentless, beautiful, but inexorable process of life which is going on inside of you that becomes frightening. And then people scream, "Get me back, get me back." The tragedy is that the LSD panic today is seen as a psychiatric problem. And, of course, the psychiatrist can't deal with a person whose ontological crisis is occurring or whose sense of reality is distorted. You can't use logic to talk to a 2-billion-year-old energy process that's converting things into a cellular flow. The tragedy is that the LSD panic person is dragged off to a mental hospital and treated as a nut. And then this can result in several weeks of confusion and depression and anxiety. Our recommendation is to see the LSD experience as life itself, is a religious quest, a religious confrontation, and not as a psychiatric pathological situation.
Well, what will your advice be to these younger people who are experimenting, whether anyone likes it or not, with these forms? Under what circumstances and with what type of help and supervision should they approach what you feel to be a very profound and important experience?
Well, we say prepare yourself for a spiritual experience, find a guru or a spiritual teacher, and study with him and have him guide you through your visionary experience. And have your LSD session in a shrine, in a place completely devoted to the spiritual quest. Of course, nobody can do this today because we don't have any gurus and we don't have shrines, and people take LSD in apartments in the North Beach or apartments in Berkeley, which is not the best place to have a mind-rending confrontation. We have, for the last 7 years, been training people in Mexico, in Millbrook, in our summer sessions, and in our psychedelic celebrations, training people how to understand and approach this really awesome experience. One other thing that I always say when I have a chance to talk to the public is a word to the parents who are concerned about their children. Now, the brute statistical reality is that in an urban center like this, almost every young person is going to be confronted with marijuana or LSD in the next year or two, and a high percentage, which varies from one-third up to two-thirds, depending on the college or the high school, will actually take LSD or marijuana. Now, the tendency of the law enforcement officers is to try to get parents to become policemen, just like Cuba or China or Germany, to get the parents to inform on their kids and to do detective work on their children. This just appalls us. My advice to parents is that you should, what's really scaring you is the breakdown between you and your kids in the way of real honest communication. And instead of swilling your martinis and your cocktails and then calling your kids dope addicts, sit down quietly and ask your youngsters why they're interested in taking marijuana and what they've learned, and find out what other kids are experiencing, and make it a family adventure of study and exploration. And then I say, after 2 or 3 months of this discussion and research and talking to people, if you and your kids think that this is a risk worth taking, do it together. One of the keys to our religious approach, social, is to bring the family back together. And in Millbrook right now, we have about 8 families who are LSD families who live together, husband, wife, and children. They take LSD together. Bonds of union and communication and family meaning develop, which I think have been lost in much of American institutional life. No government agency is going to solve our spiritual problems. I say to the parents, no government agency is going to stop your children from exploring consciousness. This is your problem of communication and collaboration and mutual understanding with your kids. Sit down and talk to them, and when the time comes, let your kids turn you on. That's my message to the middle-aged, middle-class, whiskey-drinking, suburban American family.
Well, I've heard some of the young people say that when under the influence of marijuana or LSD, that you know, that it's perfectly all right to, for example, careen around, drive a car, and do this kind of thing. What would your response to that be?
Well, that's just ridiculous and inconceivable that anyone would take one of these powerful consciousness-changing chemicals and careen around in bowling alleys or in cars or motorcycles. Sure, if you want to bowl or careen around a car, do it. But the essence of the marijuana or the LSD experience is that you're opening up these internal possibilities. It makes no more sense to me that someone would take LSD and drive a car than on the height of your honeymoon you would be making love in an automobile. Sure, you can do it, but that's a ridiculous waste of a sacred moment. It's just a sign of bad training. People don't know what they're doing, what they're getting into. As a matter of fact, we urge people, of course, I never urge anyone to take LSD or marijuana. That's your last frontier of personal choice, what you do with your nervous system. But if you're going to take LSD or marijuana, select a place that will tap the highest aesthetic and spiritual possibilities. Never take LSD in a city. Never take LSD in an apartment. Go out to the country and take time. Set up an environment which is beautiful and which will elevate you. And then there'll be no problem of LSD freakouts or anguish in the streets.
Well, now, what do you feel your practical front is like in relation to what you are doing? Do you have difficulty with the authorities in New York, and do you expect further difficulties? What do you feel the attitude?
Well, of course. See, my profession as spiritual teacher with a new sacrament is a risky one. Throughout history, people in my profession are always in a little trouble with the law. As a matter of fact, of the men whom I idolize and model myself after, with no implication I'm comparing myself with these people, but my ideals and my models have all been in jail, at best. The last four presidents of India, for example, have all spent time in jail. So jail to us is not a middle-class disgrace. Here I am, a former Harvard professor. I've been arrested three times in the last year. Isn't that disgraceful? To me, that just means I'm doing my job. And if I don't get the establishment a little worried, I wonder, my message is not getting through. Every time I'm arrested, it gives me a chance to spend a day with the other team. I spend six, 8 hours in jail until I'm bailed out, and I do with the police what I do with everyone else. I discuss with them, I argue with them, they ask questions, I challenge them, and when it's all over and I leave with my lawyer, I usually give them a copy of one of my books and autograph it, and we go back to the playing field to keep it going. This is the ancient dialogue or tension between what it belongs to Caesar and what belongs to the divinity which we locate within. Now, we have a very simple solution or formula to this old problem of Caesar and God. Anything that's outside of your body, anything that moves out there in the streets, property, territory, weapons, money, and so forth, that belongs to Caesar. And you can choose the Caesar you like and vote for him or kill for him if you're led that way. There must be laws, and we certainly agree to obeying Caesar when it comes to secular, tangible, visible activities. But when it comes to anything that goes on inside your body, that's the kingdom of heaven for you. And I cannot let Caesar, whether he's a public health official or a narcotics policeman or one of your two gubernatorial candidates in California, I can't let them tell me what changes I'm going to bring about inside my own body. No one should have anything to say about what touches your body, what goes into it. Now, if taking LSD and marijuana leads me or any of my co-religionists to break any external laws, if we get into automobile accidents, or if we take off our clothes and rush through the streets screaming about the second coming, arrest us for causing a social disorder. You've got plenty of laws in this society to arrest people for behavior. But when it comes to your body and your sense organs and changing consciousness, that's the kingdom of heaven for you. And if you let the law say anything about that, that's a making profane what should be sacred to you. We are now going to court. Our League for Spiritual Discovery has several lawyers, and we are filing suit in the state of New York which will allow the priests in our religion to import and distribute marijuana, LSD, only to our communicants in our own shrines.
And that case will be coming up.
That'll be coming up in the next 2 or 3 months. Of course, we're asking nothing more there than the Catholic priests and the Jewish rabbis requested of Caesar 40 years ago during that last period of legislative lunacy, which we call alcohol prohibition, when Catholic priests could import and distribute an illegal drug, namely wine, only in their shrines and only to their communicants. Now, the priests didn't give cocktail parties, and when we use LSD and marijuana, we won't be just having turn-on sessions in the streets. And if we do that, take our license away. There's no problem to society here, and the Constitution, wonderfully enough, guarantees this choice of conscience.
Thank you very much, Dr. Larry.
You're listening to The Psychedelic Salon, where people are changing their lives one thought at a time.
You know, I have to say that, at least in my humble opinion, the good Dr. Leary gave out a lot of really great advice just now. Granted, the screwheads who think they run things were terrified of his promotion of psychedelic medicines as a way to break the mental bondage we've been put in, but I didn't hear him talking about dosing thousands at a time, and I didn't hear him say that it was all fun and games. He seemed very responsible to me. And did you notice the question where it was insinuated that people who use LSD don't produce? In fact, even the implication that not producing is somehow bad strikes me as kind of funny. But we can talk about that another day. What I want to point out right now is that how even in seemingly friendly interviews with Dr. Leary, the questions are often loaded to point out something possibly negative about an experience that he isn't even trying to talk anyone into having, other than possibly that one offhand comment he made one time about LSD providing you with a two-hour orgasm. That comment may have led a few people who wouldn't have tried it otherwise to give it a test drive. But what I wanted to point out was that here we find way back even before there was a declared war on drugs, that the powers that be were already planting false information about our sacred medicines. And I can safely say the information about LSD turning someone into an unproductive person is wrong, because some of the most productive people in our societies have used LSD in their work, including more than one Nobel Prize winner. So don't let anyone tell you that these medicines will make you unproductive. You just have to read the label and use as directed. That's all. And let me say one more thing about the interview we just heard, and that has to do with the fact that in some very small ways, at least it seems to me, we've actually made a little progress in improving our civilization. What struck me was Dr. Leary's use of all-male terms when he was talking about historical events. For example, he said, "For thousands of years now, men have been having what we call psychedelic experiences." Now, of course, we all know that it hasn't only been men who have been having these experiences. In fact, some archaeologists are now suggesting that it may be women who first even experimented with these interesting plants. Today, at least for the most part, I find more people careful to not exclude half of the human population when making these sweeping statements. That may not seem like much of an improvement to you, but just a couple of years before this interview was held, I visited the city of New Orleans and rode on streetcars that had signs directing people of color to the back. And there were separate drinking fountains, restrooms, hotels, and so forth. Now, granted, we still have a significant way to go before there's anything close to equal opportunities for anyone who isn't a white male in this country, but just in my lifetime, I've at least seen some slight improvement. Now, one last thing I want to mention today about Timothy Leary's work has to do with his archive. Just now, we heard him talk about the pilot study his group was doing at Millbrook in regards to figuring out how to get ourselves out of this robot society we're now locked in and get back to the basics of being human. And what I want to mention is that all of the records of that work still exist in Dr. Leary's archive. Last year, I had the privilege of spending some time with this material and was astounded at some of the things I found. One of these was an experience report written by Gary Fisher, who we've hosted several times here in the salon. And when I told Gary about that particular checklist, he said that, yes, they went to great pains to document much of what transpired there during a very interesting time in the short history of the modern psychedelic movement. And it is in the preservation of that archive and several others that I would like to talk about very briefly right now. In addition to Dr. Leary's archive, I've looked through many boxes of letters, books, experience reports, and other papers from some of the other early psychedelic pioneers. And right now, the great majority of this important material is languishing in cardboard boxes that are in various storage sheds all up and down the West Coast. On another track, there's also some movement along the lines of establishing a center for the study of psychedelic medicine at one of the major universities out here. A dream of mine is to find a way to secure all of these precious physical records in a permanent archive associated with such a center, with the additional proviso, of course, that the majority of these records also be digitized and made available on the Internet. The reason I feel so passionate about preserving these resources is that as minuscule as they are, they now represent a small stake in the ground from which we can begin to recover some of the information and wisdom that has been lost in regards to these sacred medicines over the millennia. If you read Paul Devereaux's brilliant book, The Long Trip, A Prehistory of Psychedelia, you'll come away with a very clear understanding of how deeply intertwined the human psyche is with these plants and chemicals. We now know that from the late Stone Age until about 1,000 years ago, that the use of psychedelic plants in medicine was a significant part of virtually every culture on Earth. And so, how did all of this ancient knowledge disappear, you might ask? Well, we just heard another recounting of how it was the monks in the Catholic monasteries who, as this interviewer just said, acted, without any question, as the carrier of the culture. And that without those Catholic monks, the culture would have died. Well, guess what? Thanks to those Catholic monks and their inquisitor friends who followed, all traces of shamanism, witchcraft, astrology, medicine work, and all of those ancient traditions were systematically stamped out by the church in its ongoing lust for world domination. And since some people learn from history, when the U.S. of A. decided to challenge the church in the world domination game, it learned that suppression of these sacred plants was one of the keys to subduing the population, because without these sacred medicines, people just can't think for themselves. And so, the governments of the world have now declared that we shall not be allowed to eat of this fruit of the tree of knowledge because they know that an awakened populace isn't going to stand for things as they've been for far too long now. But I digress. The original point I was trying to make is that we should all take responsibility for preserving the cultural objects of our psychedelic society. I hear that early next year, Allison and Alex Gray will be moving into their own permanent Chapel of Sacred Mirrors, where some of our community's precious art will be preserved in a location where a great number of people will be able to experience it in person. So that is one huge step in the positive direction of bringing our culture more into the arena of public awareness, and hopefully we'll be able to do something similar with all of these important archives out here. So stay tuned, and I'll be talking more about this in future podcasts. Now, even though I've once again gone a little long, there are still a couple of emails I'd like to read parts of. And the first one comes from Phil, who says, and maybe this is from one of the forums that I picked it up on. I'm not sure, but anyhow, here's what Phil says. Dear Lorenzo, my dilemma is that I have no contacts in Australia who share our common interest. Can you provide me with some, or at least somewhere I can begin my own search to find them? In this message, I can't convey how and why I am so desperate to make contact with like minds, but I think you will understand. I look forward to hearing from you, or even from other Aussies who may read this. Cheers, Phil. Well, as we all know, finding the others sure isn't very easy. But one place I'd start if I were you is to begin listening to BB's Bungalow each month. You can find her podcast over at dopefiend.co.uk, along with quite a few other of my favorites. But BB is also from Down Under, and you may be able to pick up a few clues when you hear her mention a band or clubs or something. Also, if you can get to Melbourne on December 6th of this year, which is 2008, in case you're listening to this in another year, and that's possible with these podcasts, of course. Anyway, on December 6th, 2008, at the Copeland Theater at Melbourne University, there's a conference titled Entheogenesis Australis. According to their website, which is www.entheo.net, Entheogenesis Australis, EGA, is a not-for-profit association that exists to create a supportive environment that fosters mature, open discussion about psychoactive plants and chemicals. We seek to explore ways to assess societal impacts and examine the positive applications of plant-based psychoactives and empathogens. So, why don't some of you Aussies surf over to their website and see if maybe you can find a few of the others. Now, let's see, there's a couple more things I wanted to say today, and the Psychedelic Salon Quarterly. A couple of podcasts ago, I announced the beginning of this project that Dean Haddock so kindly started, and in case you missed the original announcement, I'll just briefly repeat part of it now. The Psychedelic Salon Quarterly publishes peer-reviewed articles on the subject of psychedelics, including thoughtful scientific, psychological, historical, and sociological works that for conventional or ethical reasons may not be accepted by mainstream publications. The PSQ aims to facilitate a thoughtful and scientific dialogue on the utility of psychedelic substances through legitimate research and experience. And if you'd like to participate, just surf over to psq.criticalmath.com for more details. That's psq.criticalmath.com. And Dean tells me that he's already received our first submission. I also know that Mateo is working on a rather esoteric essay to submit. And just the other day, Charlie Grobe said that he'd work something up as well. But I don't want you to think that you've got to have some kind of a big credential to have your work considered. So if you've been thinking about various aspects of the psychedelic experience that you may be able to shed some of your own bright light upon, well, why wait? Start writing today, and before you know it, you may be a published author in a peer-reviewed journal. Another announcement, one that brings me great pleasure, is to let you know that KMO's Sea Realm podcasts have been nominated for an award in the category of Culture and Arts in the annual People's Podcast Awards. And if, like me, you're a big fan of KMO's, then you can do him a great service by going to www.podcastawards.com and vote for his program. So let's all just take a minute or two out of our overly busy lives and spend those few minutes in helping KMO, who's done so much for all of us with his brilliant interviews. Finally, I want to mention an email that came from Samantha, who says in part, and don't worry, Samantha, I'm not going to reveal any of your personal information. It's just the question you ask, because it's an important one, and one that I hope over time we can all somehow figure out an answer to. So here's part of what Samantha has to say. Hi, Lorenzo. I've been listening to your podcast for quite a while now, and I really appreciate that you're getting information out there, even if I don't agree with every speaker you've had. And for what it's worth, Samantha, I don't agree with them all either. So that's a good sign, I think, that we're trying to think for ourselves a little bit. And she goes on, but what I'd really like to know is this. How do I get involved? Like a lot of people, I was raised in a society with a lot of bold-faced lies about psychedelics. And it wasn't until my mid-30s that I researched for myself and discovered how much of what I'd been given was total misinformation. I think the problem is that I mostly work in a vacuum. I seem to know far more consumers than creators, and I haven't really met a lot of people with the same sort of drive and passion that I have. So I want to get connected. I'd love to throw in and work with some other people and create positive and correct information to put out there for the world. So, any ideas or communities you could point me at? Well, Here we are back at square one again. As you know, I've talked about this on several occasions, but frankly, I don't think I've been able to add much in the way of ideas to answer this question, which is a question that's being asked every day by quite literally hundreds of thousands of people around the world who, like you and me, believe that these psychedelic substances quite possibly hold the key to our species' long-term survival. And if we don't soon learn, once again, how to integrate these magical medicines into our lives and our culture, we simply aren't going to be able to expand our thinking to the point it needs to be if we're going to work ourselves out of the ecological mess we've created here on our home planet. But getting back to Samantha's question, how do we find the others and connect with them? How do we do something of value to help the community? I guess the first thing to say is that once you do find one of the others, you'll most likely stay connected with them for a long time, just as Wild Bill and I have done, even though we live thousands of miles apart. And, you know, the same is true for other friends I've made at various conferences and festivals throughout the years. For example, my friend Fernando, who happens to live in Italy, and who I also met in Palenque a decade ago, popped up at Burning Man in 2007, and we reconnected as if no time had passed since we were last together. My point being that the psychedelic experience is so powerful that friends you make in association with these experiences, or even just at conferences and only talking about the psychedelic experience, is enough to forge a strong bond between you. Now, in a few weeks, I'll be meeting with a man who I've only talked with on the phone, but he's been involved with the same small psychedelic community for over 20 years now. And I hope to be able to record some of our conversation and play it here if he can give me some ideas that may help answer Samantha's question, which I suspect is your question as well. So for now, all I have to go on is my own experience. You know, for most of my life, I was like you, living out on the edge, but not being able to talk with anyone about it, not even my closest friends. Then I went to a McKenna 3-day workshop and met a few people, a couple of whom I'm still in contact with. And 6 months later, I attended a week-long conference, and there I met dozens of people who are now among my closest friends. Of course, these friendships didn't just blossom on their own. We stayed in touch via email and through mutual acquaintances. We exchanged ideas, we fought, and in some cases we parted company for one reason or another, just like the rest of the world does. But there is something about being friends with another psychonaut that makes things seem slightly different in some unspoken way. Well, I'm just rambling again now, so I guess the short answer to the question is no, I really don't have anything new to say right now, but for a long time I've thought that if our community had a place to meet in cyberspace, well, that would be ideal. But, you know, there are a lot of problems involved with that due to the nature of laws of various countries and the fact that you can't always keep people from doing or saying something that might get all the rest of the participants in such a virtual world into trouble. But perhaps something on a small, invitation-only basis might work. I've never mentioned this before, but the Psychedelic Salon existed for about 5 years before my first podcast. What I did was to set up an extremely secure voice channel on the net. That was back when I was still in geek mode. And six or seven of us got together for a couple of hours each week and just had some great conversations. And we were in all different parts of the country, a couple overseas actually. But we all knew one another, and we were very sure that no one could listen into our conversations. Even though we weren't talking about anything that was illegal, just knowing that our conversation was private gave us much more leeway when we wanted to discuss something. So perhaps we need to have thousands of these little groups meeting online until we figure out a safe way to interconnect them all. But hey, my ideas are kind of old and tattered now, so maybe it's time for everybody to start speaking out, and then people will find you. That's what I've done, and an amazing number of people have found me. So, in fact, one final thing that I want to do today is to say hello to one of our fellow saloners who found me somehow. I don't know his name, only that he's a taxi driver on Maui. And he sent one of his friends to meet me at the last of our little salons that was held in Venice Beach this past Friday. So now I've got two new friends in the psychedelic community, Philip and his taxi-driving friend on Maui. And I send peace, love, and light to you both. And I send it to all of our fellow saloners, especially you islanders in another part of the Pacific who are about to have a very mystic celebration in a couple days. And I'll be with you guys in spirit. You can count on that. And now, as always, I'll close this podcast by saying that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are available for your use under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at psychedelicsalon.org. And that's also where you'll find the program notes for these podcasts. For now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.